Chapter 3 KGB 2YA Mo and I have been married for years. One of the secrets of our success is that we don't harbour grudges in silence. If Mo figures I deserve it, she vents at me, and we hammer out an apology, or an agreement, or a peace treaty, or whatever it takes immediately. So it's a sign of how serious this quarrel is that she sat on it for nearly a month. And when she finally decides it's time to draw it to my attention, it's very ripe and stinky.
"You shouldn't have dragged Pete into it,"
she tells me one midweek evening as I'm clearing the kitchen table of the remains of a passable lasagna and topping up our wine glasses.
"It wasn't fair on Sandy, or the kid."
"I..."
She raises her hand, and that's when I work out she still needs to vent.
"I know what you're going to say. You're going to insist that it was time-critical, that you didn't think we had anyone on tap who could do whatever it was you needed Pete to do, and that the survival of the human race depended on it. And you're ready to back up those talking points with a well-reasoned, sensible explanation. But I'm still angry."
The worst part of it is, she's right about everything, except my having an arsenal of well-reasoned, sensible explanations to back this up. The sad fact is, Jerry Lockhart emphasised the level of confidentiality attached to that last job by ordering me not to talk about it to anyone. And the Gesh, that's part of my oath of office, won't let me break that order. It's extremely heavy-handed of him. Mo has been working as an external asset since before I heard the term, and I've been part of her support framework, and hitherto it's been mutual. However, I can't tell her a word about God Game Black without his permission, unless I want my hair to catch fire and my brains to leak out of my nose. The Gesh is intended to maintain internal security, but sometimes it has unpleasant consequences. So I just sit there and take it, with a defensive grin on my face.
"It was grossly irresponsible of you to drag him into... whatever."
So Pete hasn't told her exactly what I asked him to do for me, which was to read a stolen scan of the appendices of a rather variant version of the Bible, and give me an opinion on the sanity of the cult who were using it. It turned out to be a roadmap for engineering the Second Coming, not of Jesus, but of an ancient undead nightmare from the deep cosmological past. The cult was a megachurch in Colorado Springs. Yours truly was part of the team trying to stop them, and the consequences are classified God Game Black.
"Sandy depends on him. The kid, due in 3 months, depends on her. And he's a vicar. You just casually poked a hole in his universe. Didn't you expect that to have any consequences? He's got a family and several hundred parishioners to look after, and regardless of what you think of his belief system..."
Misguided at best, because regular Christianity doesn't have much space for the Black Pharaoh, or the Sleeper in the Pyramid, or even the normal run-of-the-mill tentacular horrors we deal with.
"He fills an important niche in delivering hope, comfort and support to vulnerable people. And you tore down the curtain and exposed him to our world, which is inevitably going to screw him up and, indirectly, screw up hundreds of other people. Some of whom might go talk to the vicar if they're feeling depressed or suicidal. Drop that stupid grin, Bob. By destabilising Pete, you could have killed people. Civilians. The people we're supposed to be protecting."
The skin on my face feels taut. I cross my arms.
How much can I say? "Remember Amsterdam?" "What, the first time, or..."
She pauses.
"You aren't allowed to talk about it?"
I manage to nod. My internal censor approves.
"You can ask."
I check with my censor. "Jerry Lockhart in External Assets.
Please, Mo. I can't defend myself. I can't even apologise. I am not allowed to talk about this." "Well, shit!"
This is strong language for Mo. Her gaze flickers away from me, some of her electric anger seeking a new channel to Earth. She knows about the Gesh, the binding compulsion to silence. We usually have a waiver that allows us to talk about work. A year or so ago, she had to do a job in Amsterdam. Wet work, because that's what Agent Candid sometimes does, and came home in pieces because some idiot up the line had explicitly forbidden her from talking to me. I'm her support system. I'm not in the same line of work exactly, but I'm close enough to understand what she goes through and help her deal with it. That time I hunted down the idiot in question and sorted it out, probably saving our employers a very expensive medical leave bill. This time the boot is on the other foot. If I could tell her what happened in Colorado Springs, she'd... Well, no, she probably wouldn't forgive me. But she'd understand why and take it into account, which amounts to much the same. Hate the sin, love the sinner. It's hard to stay pissed off at someone for doing something wrong if you know you'd have done exactly the same thing if you'd been standing in their shoes. I shove a topped-up wine glass across the table towards her. You need Pete and Sandy for your own reasons. She nods. Her neck muscles are still tense, but she takes the glass.
I can't afford to lose track of normal, Bob. Most of our friends aren't normal anymore. Neither are we.
I take a sip. Okay, a mouthful of Pinot Noir, and swallow. Dead right. Pete, vicar, and Sandy, teacher, are some of our few remaining friends outside the organisation. If I was a Harry Potter fan, and offensively stupid besides, I'd call them muggles. But that's exactly the wrong way to look at the picture. Those of us who have too much to do with the supernatural aren't wizards, but monsters, or in danger of becoming monsters. Over time, most of our circle have either moved away or started families. We increasingly socialise with workmates, because it's safe and easy. They understand why we can't talk about certain parts of our office days, and we don't risk endangering their worldview by accidentally exposing them to the nihilistic truth. Our grip on everyday normality is, shall we say, eroding, like the cliffs north of Aldborough. Lose that grip and... We need more normal in our life, I say. Especially now that I've been roped into... I can't say it. Into the irregular twilight at the edge of the organisation that she's been quietly slipping in and out of for so long, carrying that damned violin.
Easier said than done.
She takes in some wine, then slowly twirls the stem of the glass between her fingers, staring at the film of red washing up the sides of the bulb. I've seen this often enough to realise that right now she's in danger of tipping from anger into bitterness.
We haven't been normal since...
We could go out more often, I suggest. Do normal things, meet normal people. Take up... I search for a good idea, come up blank. Going to the theatre? Opera? I detest opera, and have no time for classical music in general, but Mo is rather a keen violinist. Bingo? Her cheek twitches.
We're a bit young for that, dear.
We could get a cat. I'm not sure where that idea comes from. But it's an ordinary people kind of thing to do. Normal folks can also have children, but in our line of work that would be highly inadvisable. Even if we wanted kids, knowing the nature of the world we'd be bringing them into would give us second thoughts. But a cat? What could possibly go wrong with that?
Are you volunteering for litter tray duties?
I shrug. It can't be worse than riding herd on software updates for 6 computers, 2 phones and a tablet. Can it?
If you're sure.
Her eyes narrow.
A cat.
Pause.
Have you ever lived with a cat before?
Vague memories of a purring warm lump sitting on my lap during family visits to my great aunt percolate to the surface. Ellis Billington's Fluffy, I can safely discount. We are discussing standard issue, non-supernatural felines, after all, not the alien in a cat suit kind. Not personally, but I've had visiting rights.
Oh, good. Well, I think it'd be really nice to know that when things go bump in the night, it's just a cat knocking over the glassware to hear it shatter, so why not?
She knocks back half the contents of her wine glass in one.
Yes, let's do that.
It suddenly dawns on me that I know about as much about looking after a pet cat as I know about flying a jet fighter. It's all meow daka daka zoom to me. I think we need to do some research first. Vets, food, that sort of thing?
No, Bob, she smiles at last. You need to do some research. Litter tray duties, remember?
Oh, bloody hell. It slowly dawns on me that while she can't justify berating me over Pete anymore, She can still extract a cold revenge. Making me responsible for a small furry life form's well-being, meanwhile adding an extra kilogram or two of ballast to help anchor her fraying connection to normality. Well, I suppose so. I finish my wine. But if I'm looking after it, I get to choose what we adopt. Okay? After we do the washing up, I get to spend the rest of the evening reading FAQs on cat maintenance on the web. It takes about half an hour to come to the unwelcome realization that they're almost as complex as homebrew gaming PCs, and have even more failure modes. When your gaming PC malfunctions, it doesn't stealthily dump core in your shoes. But I have made my bed, and I must lie in it. So I pencil in a date at the nearest RSPCA shelter for next Saturday. On the other hand, for the first time in nearly a month, I don't get to sleep on the sofa bed in the spare room. So perhaps the worst is over. 2 days later, I'm in the office, working on a pile of virtual paperwork. You would not believe how many hoops you have to jump through to gain access to the NHS's core statistical data warehouse if you're not a 16-headed committee from a designated strategic health authority, when there's a knock on my door. I hit save and look up, then mash my finger on the button that flips the red secret light to green. What I'm working on isn't actually secret in the first place, just mildly embarrassing. But secrecy is a reflex. Come in, I call as the door opens. Then I do a double take. Pete? His head is swiveling like a bird scarer, taking in my 12 square meters of squalor.
Bob, they told me you worked here, but I didn't quite realize.
Come in, sit down. I suddenly realize there's nowhere to sit. The visitor's chair is currently occupied by three broken computers. The uppermost one is a floppy disk-only 286 lunchbox that somebody forgot to check back into inventory in 1994. I've already spent a couple of days trying to figure out a way to legally decommission it, because current regulations insist that all computers must have their hard disk or SSD shredded and disposed of securely, and any exceptions require sign-off by a security audit team, which was unfortunately dissolved 2 years ago. I sweep the detritus onto the floor and turn the chair to face him.
You're here now.
Pete sits on the edge of the chair, his expression somewhere between mildly puzzled and pained.
Yes,
he says, and waits. That's when the oh shit moment hits me.
This is my fault, I say in a small voice.
Is it really?
His expression brightens abruptly.
I thought you probably came into it somewhere along the line. Was it that fragment you sent me?
I sigh. How long since they swept you up?
About 3 weeks. I had a visit from a couple of polite gentlemen who asked me to sign the Official Secrets Act. In blood.
Pete is clearly mildly perturbed by this, as so he should be. His faith doesn't have much room for sanguinary magic, unless you count Holy Communion.
Then they explain that you do secret work for the government, and if I talk about it to outsiders without permission, my eyeballs will boil. Is it true, Bob? I mean, how true is it?
I oscillate for a moment between a frantic urge to run for the hills, a residual instinctive urge to flannel Pete with half-truths, and the doleful realization that it's probably best to tell him the unvarnished truth. That way there's no room for misunderstandings later.
It's mostly true, I'm afraid. This organization, the Laundry...
I'm watching his eyes for any sign of surprise, and I don't see anything, which means he already knows too much for his own good.
Is the part of the Secret Service that deals with occult and magical threats. I've worked here for some time. Since before I met Mo, actually.
About 12 years ago.
I'm a specialist.
I can't quite bring myself to say necromancer to a vicar.
Well, I suppose that brings me to my next question. Mo, does she work here too?
Part-time, I admit.
Yes, we've been holding out on you. We were required to, actually. We deal with stuff that's best not talked about in public.
I watch him, but he doesn't look surprised. He just sits there, marinating in the ambience of my most secret office, nostrils flaring at the faint pong of essence de spook.
I crack first. If we talked about it, it would scare people, I tell him.
Stuff like that piece of apocrypha you emailed me last month?
He asks. Yes. I unwind infinitesimally. It's our job to protect people from that sort of thing. And worse. I instinctively glance towards my bookcase. There, sitting in front of a pile of CS textbooks, is a Bible. It's the one the Golden Promise Ministries used, with added special sauce in the Apocrypha. I make a judgment call and pass it to him. I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to talk about what happened out there, but here's the original source material. Or rather, a copy we bargained with the Black Chamber, our American opposite numbers, for. Not that they had any reason to withhold it after we saved their ass. Pete holds the Bible uncertainly, as if he's afraid its cover is coated in contact poison.
They told me their last expert on Aramaic studies and biblical apocrypha died some years ago, and would I mind very much taking on that role on a part-time consultative basis, as and when?
Yes. I didn't know about the last expert angle, but it sets my mind at rest somewhat. How about we get a mug of coffee and I show you around? Whatever you're cleared for, once I've established your access controls, I add silently for my own benefit.
Coffee would be great, but as for the tour, I'm not sure it's necessary.
He looks slightly sheepish.
They told me they won't be needing me here routinely. I'm supposed to look at your archives and learn the procedures for accessing files, and, that's all for now, and they'll call me if anything comes up.
He makes a dust-off gesture with his left hand. That's probably all for the best. I stand and lead the way towards the coffee station.
It's not as if you don't already have a job, is it? A vocation, actually. But yes.
He ambles along behind me like an oversized penguin, glancing amiably from side to side, taking it all in. The heart of the secret state, all puke-green paint, chipped lino, and loose-lip-sink-ships posters, left over from the last war but one. Our decor is so cheesy, it's almost regained a hipsterish modicum of cool.
So is it true, then, that you single-handedly turned back an alien invasion of tentacle monsters who were being summoned by our dispensationalist brethren with the non-standard user manual?
I wince.
Is that what they told you? Because if, not in quite so many words, so they exaggerated my but they were quite effusive about success what?
I grind to a halt, two doors past the gents, and take a deep breath. I'm not James Bond, Pete. Just a bad occasional stunt double. For the extras, I add, before he gets the wrong end of the stick. You know, the ones who get beaten up? I cross my arms defensively, wrapping a hand around my upper right bicep, which has a curious rectangular dent in it. Covered by a skin graft about 10 centimetres long, a souvenir from some very unpleasant people I met a couple of years ago. It's nothing like as romantic as movies or TV make it out to be. Or books, damn it.
But you're in the job of protecting us from...
Yes, exactly. I start walking again. Round the bend, then we come to the coffee station. We tend to pool mugs here. I grab a couple of chipped promotional beakers, left over from a long-defunct mini-computer vendor, and slop the evil-smelling brew into them. Milk, one sugar, I remember on Pete's behalf.
Seriously, I didn't want to trouble you with that stuff, but I was out of options and you were the only person I knew who stood a hope of delivering an interpretation in time. Looks like upstairs agreed with me, unfortunately, which is why it's entirely my fault you're drinking London's worst institutional coffee right now. I owe you a huge, grovelling apology.
No, you don't.
What?
Pete waves his mug around, eyes gleaming.
This is amazing! It's all real!
His response is so enthusiastic and so unexpected that he's reduced me to monosyllables. That's a bad sign.
Bob, first of all, I like to think that the most important point of my vocation is helping people. Helping with grief, with love, with faith, with life's challenges. You've given me a better way to help more people. Do you really expect me to object to that? And secondly, you've given me some pause for reappraisal.
The demon business, the whole nightmare monsters from beyond space-time thing, the zombies. Yes, I can see why you might expect that to shake my faith in God's love. But don't you think that's a little superficial? There's another way of looking at them, which is as evidence that the supernatural exists and is important. Where God fits into all of this, I can't say, but I can say that these so-called elder gods don't invalidate his existence. They don't prove a negative. If anything, they make God's message of love more important in a human context.
I take a mouthful of lukewarm, bunker oil-flavoured cow piss and try not to gag as my Weltanschauung strips its gears. His optimism is sunny, invincible, and just slightly pitiable. I'm about to open my mouth and say something inadvisable when I realise that, actually, I don't want to do that. I may be turning into a cynical old fart, but that's no reason to drag down everyone around me at the same time. So I open my mouth and say something else instead. I think I can agree with the sentiment, if not the details. Then, moving swiftly on, but they wouldn't have dragged you in here just for a mug of coffee, would they?
No. They said they want me to know where the archive stacks are and how to access them. Then I've got what they called a training wheels assignment, after which I go back in the box until they need me.
He sniffs, mildly disapproving.
It's supposed to demonstrate competence with the library system, I gather, after I told them about my doctorate.
Yeah, right. I roll my eyes. They're big on that, assuming the they we are talking about is someone in induction and training.
Does Ellen McQueen ring a bell?
Yes, yes, it does. I shrug. Did she give you a timescale or a classification level for this assignment? I begin walking slowly back towards my office.
Yes, it's open-ended and the material is intended for public dissemination when the time comes. Meanwhile, it's considered confidential. Is that...
Huh. The confidential bit is reasonable. No offence, but we don't hand secret materials to trainees, even if they've passed positive vetting. But open-ended?
Apparently it's expected to take some time. You were not expected to finish this job, she said. Those were her exact words.
What? I think for a moment. That doesn't make any kind of sense to me. What did she say you were to do?
There was some sort of civil defence programme from the 1970s called Protect and Survive, she said. That was back during the Cold War. It was a booklet and posters and a bunch of recorded radio and TV broadcasts about how to survive a nuclear attack. And in the event of a war situation breaking out, they were going to distribute the booklets and run the broadcasts. Sort of a public information thing, I gather. Although the main effect was to drive graphic designers to suicide.
He chuckles. Oh, dear fricking. What he's telling me finally sinks in. You mean the laundry has a public information campaign stored up and ready to roll in event of case... Sorry, in event of us being invaded by tentacle monsters from another dimension?
Yes, that's exactly it. Only it was last updated in 1983. Take a look at it, she said, and write a proposal for bringing it up to date.
Did it have a name, this project?
Yes. The books and posters are called Magic Circle of Safety, but she said I'd find it in the stacks under a very strange reference. KGB 2YA. What's so funny? Bob? Are you choking? Bob? Bob, do you need help?
Kiss goodbye to your ass. I love the laundry sense of humour.
I'm okay, I finally wheeze as I exhale the last of my half-lungful of coffee. Let's go check it out.
KGB 2YA. How bad can it be? In the end, we go back to my office, whereupon a couple of emails and a phone call confirm that Pete has actually been sent an orientation pack, not arrived yet, and assigned to my guest chair for the next week. Doubtless this is my punishment for increasing the departmental headcount and simultaneously downsizing our office floor space with Angleton's help. I gather Andy is still in full-on office-flying Dutchman mode.
Looks like we're hot-desking or something, I explain. Let's do lunch and I'll take you to the archives afterwards.
The Dancy House refurbishment may be stalled, but the archive stacks deep beneath the basement are still in business. They're built inside segments of deep-running tube tunnels that were excavated before and after the Second World War, to double as air raid shelters and blitzproof government offices. Nuclear weapons made them obsolete for their original purpose, and the London Underground never asked to have their tube station back. So we hung on to it, and filled it with microfiche cards and, latterly, storage servers. You thought the gigantic new London water mains were installed to supply the capital with drinking water? Well, yes, they were, but only after we've used them as a heat sink for our equipment racks. But we don't end up in the deep stacks. Before lunch, I take Pete to visit old Basil in archives to ask for the shelf locator of KGB 2YA. This is necessary because Basil is one of our pensioners, the ones who don't retire so much as they subside into the furniture, and the most advanced technology he can operate reliably is his hearing aid, which whistles irritatingly, like a mosquito scraping its fingernails down a blackboard. He doesn't answer his email, instant messaging might as well be rocket science, and a voice call is inevitably frustrated by the intermittently faulty induction loop on his desk phone. Luckily, Basil is okay if you visit him in person, so I procure a map and a signed authorization chitty before taking Pete to the canteen for lunch. British institutional keg curry and naan for me, beans on toast for him. Afterwards, back in my office, "You have got to be shitting..." "Sorry." I peer at the hand-scrawled carbon copy again, double-checking it. "You're sure that was the right reference?" Pete rummages in the ring binder that Trish inflicted on him when he arrived. "Yes, that's the one." "Well, it's in a warehouse in Watford, most of the way out to the M25. I didn't even know we had a warehouse in Watford. It'll take us 3 hours to get there and back by tube, so I suppose..." "I brought the Vespa." Pete diffidently jangles a bunch of keys. "Can you ride Pillion?" Vickers on vintage scooters. What is the world coming to? I'm just glad I don't have hemorrhoids. Pete has parked in an alley round the back of the new annex, between two dumpsters full of non-office waste. It's raining, and I'm glad I decided to wear a parka to work, even though it makes me look like a dork. He passes me a spare helmet, and I'm busy fiddling with the chin strap when I get a peculiar feeling that I'm being watched. I open an inner eye and whip my head around. There's a startled hiss, and a black bolt of lightning scoots under the nearer dumpster. It's not a feeder, nor is it a human intruder. I gulp with relief. Green eyes flash at me from the shadows, then retreat into darkness. "What's up?" Pete asks, noticing my startle reflex. "Just a stray cat. Maybe feral. I need to stop jumping at shadows, I think. Let's go." I have heard that the second fastest way to get around central London is on two wheels. Well, if your range needs to encompass the entire area within the M25 orbital motorway, you either need Lance Armstrong's prescription cabinet or a motor. Pete gives me a demonstration of the latter. We make it out to Watford in less than half an hour, faster than I could have managed even given a bicycle and access to the key line paths of power that thread the capital's disused railways and cuttings. Unfortunately, I also discover that riding Pillion in the rain without leathers is a great way to get soaked to the skin and chilled. And while I don't get car sick or plane sick, I am quite capable of getting nauseous on the back of a scooter. Nevertheless, Pete gets us there in miraculously short order. We dismount in a car park, round the side of an anonymous-looking industrial unit with roll-ups, and I stumble dizzily towards the windowless door. There is a doorbell and a small camera. I ring the bell and present my warrant card to the camera. After a moment, Pete remembers to pull out his shiny new ID. It doesn't come with a special sauce yet, but at least it'll get him in the door, if he's accompanied by an irresponsible adult.
"Who's there?"
"Bob Howard and Pete Wilson, Capital Laundry Services."
"Come in."
There's a buzz, and I push the door open. The office inside is tiny, occupied by the middle-aged security guard who was playing solitaire on his phone when I interrupted his brilliantly exciting afternoon.
"Yes?"
he asks resentfully. "We called ahead." I try not to look disapprovingly at his game. Rule number one of working at remote offices is never to piss off site security. "We need access to the stores." I hold up the slightly rusty keyring I checked out from Archives Reception, and Pete produces a file from somewhere inside his bulky leather jacket and slides out an authorization form.
"Go on in. You're going to be long."
"Don't know yet." I glance at Pete, make eye contact, and nod infinitesimally. "We'll let you know. When do you go off shift?"
"I gotta be out by 5.
"Okay. If we're still going, knock on the door 10 minutes before you're ready to leave, and we'll wrap up."
"Let me see that badge again."
I show him my warrant card, and he scrawls something that might be cryptographically related to my name and departmental number on a dog-eared sheet clipped to a board hanging by the door. Then he goes back to his solitaire game. I turn the key, reach round the door to flick on the light switch, and together, Pete and I enter the KGB 2YA archive. It has been said that Her Majesty's government finds it extremely difficult to throw anything away. Like your mad old aunt who lives in a flat with 16 commemorative royal family tea sets, 30 cubic meters of yellowing newspapers and an incontinent dachshund, the government hangs on to stuff until long after it becomes obvious that it lacks any conceivable use. As late as 1982, they kept a strategic reserve of 160 steam locomotives in a vast underground complex at Corsham, near Bath, in case they had to rebuild the British railway network after a nuclear war. They also kept a Second World War Jeep factory, 5 million battery-powered radios, and 23 million body bags at the same depot. The official government random number generator used for seeding new encryption keys is a thing of legend, running as it does on a type of punched paper tape that hasn't been manufactured since the 1950s. We had to invent some really neat hacks using digital cameras to read it into our oldest trailing-edge mini-computers in order to use those numbers. And rumour has it that the central ammunition depot, hanging off Box Tunnel, still contains 2,000 barrels of iron-tipped English longbow arrows, in case it becomes urgently necessary to refight the Battle of Crecy. But these pale into insignificance compared to the glorious, pointless obsolescence that fills the Magic Circle of Safety warehouse.
"Dear God," whispers Pete. "It's full of posters."
He's not wrong. The warehouse is full of floor-to-ceiling, heavy-duty steel shelves, construction-built to take timbers. The nearest aisle to us is not full of wood, though. Instead, every available niche is jammed with pallets laden with broadsheet-sized posters, stacked half a metre deep and strapped in place. I do some quick mental arithmetic and realise there has to be upwards of 100,000 public notices here. I really don't want to risk any of the shelves falling on me. While the pallets are tagged for easy identification, someone has taken the trouble to hang a copy of each poster by the side of the shelves that hold the stock. The design values are classical, and not in a good way. Two-colour printing on plain white paper. Here is the parliamentary portcullis and crown symbol, sitting atop a perspective flattened summoning grid, menaced by cartoonish green tentacles to ram home the message, "Stay in the circle." And there is a symbolic nuclear family. Tall male toilet door figure, shorter female toilet door figure, two small mini-me's, gathered under an elder sign. "Cultist danger. Watch your neighbours for this sign." I wince at this latter. The next cultist I meet who can tell an elder sign from Transport for London's new logo will be the first. And don't get me started on the occult symbol they used for the Olympics. I look down the aisle. Yes, there it is. "Protect and survive," with added magic circle goodness. Tentacles replace mushroom clouds in the variant semiological design language of pants-wetting despair at imminent brain-eating catastrophe.
"Is that," Pete says in an awe-muffled voice, pointing, "a box of LPs?"
I follow his aim. Yes, there is indeed some sort of ancient gramophone contraption sitting on one of the shelves, next to an open box containing black plastic discs about 30 centimetres in diameter. You mean the things they used to use before compact discs?
Yes, Bob. Surely you must remember.
Yes, I remember. Just. I walk towards the music player. There's something wrong with these discs. They're not quite the same as the ones my dad used to play. I get a bit closer before I can see properly. They're too thick.
That's Bakelite, Bob. Modern discs are made of vinyl. Ahem.
Pete carefully extracts one of the discs from the velvet-lined box they're racked in.
Wow! Look, these are 16s.
What's that?
You play them at 16 revolutions per minute, not 33 or 45. Lousy high-frequency response, but great for speech, and they run for twice as long. I bet these were specially mastered in the late 60s. They didn't know how well magnetic tape would survive.
But what would they do with them?
Broadcast them, probably, from the emergency command and control bunkers they had set up for running the country, in event of a nuclear war. They had radio transmitters, didn't they? I saw a TV drama about it years ago, called Threads.
He looks at me curiously.
Would public broadcasting still work after an invasion of wibbly-wobbly nasties? What about the internet?
I scuff my shoe on the bare concrete. This stuff is useless. They haven't blown the dust off it in 30 years. I look around. I mean, it's useless except for kitsch value.
Well, that's not quite right. You might get the service museum curator excited. But I don't see any of this junk going viral like Keep Calm and Carry On. It lacks a certain je ne sais quoi, Pete agrees. But what am I going to do?
I shrug. You're going to dig out the original brief for the folks who came up with this stuff. I figure it'll turn out to be come up with a public information campaign or something along those lines. Then you're going to write a proposal for how to update the brief for a new generation, so that the new media hipsters can all point and laugh at us. It'll get outsourced to a security-cleared agency, who in turn will pitch an iPhone app and a Facebook page. But by then you'll be signed off the job, so tearing off their heads and shitting down their necks as you explain in words of one syllable that we can't trust Apple or Facebook won't be your problem. I pause. I can help you with that. It shouldn't take more than a couple of days. On the other hand, I've got a little project of my own I'm working on, and I could do with some help. And a library researcher is exactly what I need. Are you up for it?
Thus, I seal my fate.